Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we pick a new or newish book, and we interview the author or authors of that book. And this week I'm very pleased to say we have John Earl Haynes on the show and Harvey Clare, and we'll be talking about their book, which they co-wrote with Alexander Vasilyev, Spies, The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America. I thought this book was absolutely fascinating. I'm a Russian historian myself, though of the pre-modern period. I did, however, follow what had come out about the history of the Communist Party in the United States and the Soviets' efforts, successful efforts, I think, to manage that party and use it to infiltrate various parts of what I would really call the American establishment, because I don't think they got into Kansas where I'm from. Maybe they did. But people who were sort of born very well and did the right things and read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, they were the kind of people who were recruited. And it turns out that they were pretty successful in recruiting them, more successful than we knew. And this is an interesting book in the sense that it has what mathematicians call a finding. That is, we really know something new as a result of this book. And we know it because new sources appeared, and John and Harvey were fortunate enough to get their hands on the notebooks of Alexander Vasilyev. They're a rather famous document in Russian history now, or Soviet history, and they'll talk a little bit about that document, which was very important for the real revelations. I don't know if revelations is the right word, because the accusations had been around for a long time, but they sort of clear things up for us, and they do it in a wonderful way. And it's a really very interesting read for anybody who's followed this kind of thing over the years, as I have. So, John and Harvey, thanks very much for being on the show.
Delighted to be here.
Yes, very good to be here.
All right, so maybe we could take one after another. John, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a historian by training. I have just recently retired, but from 1987 until fall of last year, I was the modern political historian in the manuscript division of the Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm. And Harvey?
I'm a professor of political science and history at Emory University in Atlanta, and not quite retired yet, but getting close, and spent my career writing about American communism.
I see. So both of you then knew a lot about the history of American communism prior to the fall of the Soviet Union. You had studied these questions, right?
Yes. I had done my dissertation back in the Stone Age on something called the theory of American exceptionalism, which was the issue of, in Marxist theory, about whether America fit Marxist conceptions of the development of societies. And throughout the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, I had written about American communism, the American Communist Party itself. And really, in 1992, my career took a real jag because I went to Russia. It was now Russia, no longer the Soviet Union, on a research trip. I was going to go in a different direction, and I was fortunate enough to be there shortly after the failed coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. And Boris Yeltsin had seized the Communist Party's property, and among that property were Communist Party archives, and he opened them up, and I was one of the first scholars, probably the first American scholar, and one of the first Westerners to get access to that material. And so my research began to turn a little bit more in the direction of espionage, somewhat to my surprise.
Mm-hmm. And John, you'd study this stuff as well?
Well, yes. Originally, I got into the area sort of by a side door. I was in graduate school in Minnesota and had decided to do a dissertation on the history of the Democratic Farm Labor Party, which is the name of the Democratic Party in Minnesota. It's the product of a merger in 1944 of the Democratic Party, which was then the third largest party in the state, and the Farmer Labor Party, which was the second largest party. At that time, Republicans were the largest party in Minnesota. But the early history of the DFL was a bit murky, and I decided a study of it would be useful. And when I got into the research, rather to my surprise, I found there was a role of the Communist Party involved in it, in the farmer labor side, going back to the middle of the 1930s. And so my that piqued my interest in the role of communists in mainstream politics, and particularly in the development of liberalism in the 1930s and 1940s. And I found that a great many historians tended to avoid dealing with the history of the Communist Party in terms of its involvement in mainstream politics. So I found it an area where there were great many opportunities for research and writing, and got involved in that. But like Hardy, my interest in this area until the 1990s really was in domestic politics, really in the role of communists and anti-communists in domestic American politics. Espionage really was not an interest or a focus of my research. But after Hardy found some material in one of Moscow's archives, which indicated the party was more involved with espionage than either of us had thought, well, we felt it would be kind of silly not to pursue that, and that got us into the area, and that really has been the focus of our research since the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm. I think what's incredibly unusual about this is usually historians are... what is the right word? They're very focused on one thing, and they stay on that one thing no matter what happens. And it seems to me that you fellas sort of switched courses once you saw that there was an opportunity. So that speaks very well of both of you.
Well, I mean, part of that, quite frankly, was exhaustion. both of us have been studying American communism for a long time, and quite frankly, if you read enough American Communist Party documents and FBI files about American communism, it's just mind-numbing. Particularly the American Communist Party rhetoric, it's just incredibly cliche-ridden and boring So I'd been doing that for over 20 years, and boy, was I tired of it. And mm-hmm. and the other factor was there was a pretty nasty set of disputes going on within the study of American communism between people, for shorthand, could be called traditionalists on the one side and revisionists on the other. John and I were two of the very small band of traditionalists. That is, people who argued that the American Communist Party had really been an instrument of Moscow. And on the other side were the revisionists, many of whom had come out of the New Left of the 1970s, who argued that the American Communist Party was really a genuinely American democratic organization that had valiantly fought for civil rights and labor organizing and anti-fascism and had really been destroyed and demonized by McCarthyism and American Red Scare. And those debates had been going on for a long time, and we'd been lobbing grenades and artillery across no man's land. And quite frankly, I think both John and I were sort of tired of the arguments and looking for something else, and this espionage material turned up. And fortuitously, it supported our argument.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess another thing that's very interesting about this is that when this new information came to light, you had, as you say, a kind of set of questions that were being debated at the time, and you could focus on those questions, which is very, I think, unusual for historians. That is, usually we go into, at least in my case, I go into archives, I don't know what I'm going to find, and I don't exactly know what I'm looking for. But here it seems that there are names that people who listen to this show will know, Robert Oppenheimer and Alger Hiss and the Rosenbergs and, you know, Kim Philby and the rest. I mean, we know about these people precisely because they were debated, were in the press, and, you know, campaigns were mounted to prove their innocence, or campaigns were mounted to help their children, or campaigns were mounted to really vilify them. And even when I was an undergraduate in the 80s, this was still alive. I mean, people still talked about these things, and it's all kind of gone now. And maybe thanks to your research, it's kind of gone. But even this week, as I told you in the pre-interview, I was listening to local radio, and one of the Rosenberg's sons lives in Western Massachusetts, where I live. And he was on the radio, and he said some very interesting things. He did not say that his parents were innocent. He did not exactly say they were guilty. Maybe he did say they were guilty, but it's still alive in the American mind, this notion that somehow there was this witch hunt. So let's actually turn to the information itself. What kind of information did you have new access to, who produced it, and what did it say?
You're referring to the book, to the material for the Spies book.
Yeah, the Spies book. That's right. And I'm thinking about particularly the Vasiliev, which is a very interesting. You could write a book about the story of that guy,
right?
The Vasiliev, but also the material that you found I think it's all in the Presidential Archive now. All the stuff's closed again. So the material, the KGB material,
right?
John or Harvey?
John, you want to go ahead?
All right. I think in terms of the Vasiliev material, it's important to remember that the KGB archives have really never been open, even in the most open period in the 1990s. The KGB archives are actually, at that point, of course, the KGB no longer existed. The archives of the Soviet Intelligence Agency, now the SVR, the Russian Intelligence Agency, the SVR, but the SVR had, in that period, allowed some material, a limited amount, to be made public indirectly. In the early 90s, when things were in a bit of chaos in the new Russia, and the intelligence agencies were vastly underfunded, and they were having trouble maintaining pension payments to their ex-officers, the SVR decided to sign a fairly lucrative book contract with Crown Publishers, a Western American publisher, to publish a series of books about Soviet intelligence, where they would pair a serving or retired KGB officer with a Western author. Only the Russian partner, the retired or active intelligence officer, would have access to the archive. He would have access to the material and then would prepare summaries of relevant documents and make them available to the Western co-author, who would then write the book. And a series of books were planned, and a number of them were published. This project came to an end in the middle 90s when the SVR regained its standing in the new Russian government and was no longer as desperate for funds as it has been, and the project was simply canceled. But it had produced some books, and one of them was to be a book on Soviet intelligence operations in the United States in the 1930s and 40s. In this case, the Russian co-author was Alexander Vasiliev. He had been a young KGB officer in the late 1980s, and had actually resigned from the agency in 1990 as things were falling apart, and he became a journalist in the new Russia, but then was asked to come back in 1992 on a sort of contract basis to assist with the project of the book on Soviet operations in the U.S. in the 30s and 40s. So he came back and worked part-time at the SVR headquarters and had access to the archival material in this period. He couldn't make actual copies of the documents, but he was able to make whatever notes he wanted, and he took them home with him. He actually made them in notebooks. He altogether accumulated around 1,115 pages of material. Alexander was very meticulous in how he did it. He would either write a summary or simply copy, extract, sometimes several pages of quoted material. He always noted exactly what document it was from, what file the material was found in, and he also would make annotations about the identification of certain things. Now, these notebooks he kept with him. They were not kept by the SVR. He did, in 1996, though, as this project was coming to a close, he became very concerned that things were changing in Russia, with the SVR regaining its footing in the Russian government. He was concerned that elements in the SVR that were hostile to the project from the beginning were now going to look for scapegoats because they thought the project was leading to the disclosure of secrets. And that he, as a former officer, not even still a serving officer, was scapegoat material, particularly for the still strong communist element in the SVR. And he was concerned that, remember, there was a presidential election in Russia that year, and it looked like the communist candidate might defeat Yeltsin. So the Soviet decided it was time to leave Moscow. So he got a journalistic assignment in London and left, and has never gone back, and he's now a British subject. At that time, he did not take the notebooks with him. He left those with friends. What he took with him were the sanitized summaries, and those were then given to Alan Weinstein and for the production of the book The Haunted Wood by Weinstein and Vasiliev. And it was an excellent book with a great deal of interesting new material. It was based on Alexander's sanitized summaries. I might add the summaries were which Alexander had prepared under the standards of this Crown Book project. He was supposed to, in the summaries, not to identify cover names with their real names, and there were some things he wasn't supposed to talk about whatsoever. And the sanitized summaries had also had to go through an SVR committee of senior officers to make sure that really sensitive material was not being disclosed. But nonetheless, the sanitized summaries had all kinds of new material in them, and that produced an excellent book, The Haunted Wood. But it is not the summaries are not the same things as Alexander's original notebooks, which are far more detailed, not sanitized whatsoever. They were written originally for just his own benefit. And it was from them that he prepared the summaries. Well, after a few years, he had his friends in Moscow send him his notebooks in London. He actually used a page or two from one of the notebooks as a piece of evidence in a libel trial he was involved with involving the Haunted Wood book. And a friend of mine got a photocopy of one of those pages he used in the trial and sent it to me. It was handwritten in Russian. I had some colleagues of mine who can read handwritten Russian that translated it for me. It was an extremely interesting page, particularly because it had material that had not appeared in the Haunted Wood, some very sensitive material, which I found intriguing. I wondered why Alan Weinstein, an excellent historian, hadn't used this material. Well, of course, eventually I would find out because Alan hadn't seen it. Alan had only had the sanitized summaries to work with, not Alexander's original notebooks. Well, I then put the translation of the page along with the page itself on the web on my own website because it was of interest to those of us involved in the area of espionage history. And after a few months after that, I got an email from Alexander Vasiliev. I had no contact with him. And he said he had been surfing the web and up top his own page. His email was, the spies to see it, we're okay with him. And then he said the translation was excellent, but he thought there were a few words that my translator had gotten wrong because he couldn't read his handwriting correctly, mm-hmm. and he had a correction for it. Well, of course, I appreciated that and responded, and then asked him, are there more pages like this? And I explained why I was interested. And then he replied and explained what I've just told you about, that he had these notebooks, over 1,000 pages of material like this. And he said there was all kinds of information in them that was not in the summaries he had that had been used in the Haunted Wood. And by the way, did I know any American historians who might be interested in looking at them for a possible another book? Well, of course I did. So Harvey and I were on a plane a week later to London to look at Alexander's notebooks.
Yeah, that is a fascinating story. And then they become, I wouldn't say it's the basis. I don't know. It becomes an important element of the book Spies.
I would say the basis.
Okay. Well, there's other material that was released as well, the Verona material, for example.
Yeah, well, the great thing about Alexander's material is that it corroborated and expanded on what we knew from Venona.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Venona was this National Security Agency project to decode Soviet communications mostly during World War II. Between Moscow and its stations around the world, including the United States, and the Venona material, John and I had written a book about it, based on it, because the NSA and FBI had released that material in the 1990s. The Venona material was often fragmentary. These were cables sent between, say, New York, Washington, San Francisco, and Moscow. And they were often short. Many of the cables were only partially decrypted. They were fascinating and very revealing, but they left a lot of holes. And the wonderful thing about the Vasiliev material is that it filled in many of those holes. For example, Venona messages that had been printed by or released by the NSA might have, let's say, there'd be a sentence that would be decrypted, and then there would be in brackets a thing saying unrecovered, 37 lines unrecovered. They could not break into that material. Well, Alexander, in some cases, had copied the full message. A number of the cover names that had appeared in Venona that American counterintelligence had never been able to identify were identified mm-hmm. in Alexander's notebooks. And in one fascinating case, the NSA had identified a cover name, and in Alexander's notebooks, it was a different person. And when we went back and looked at that individual and what was in Venona, it was clear that the notebooks were correct, that the NSA had misidentified this particular source. So it was just an incredible resource because if you've worked in archives, you know that you have to be cautious about documents you find in archives. The person that produces the document may be misinformed or mistaken or make an error or be self-serving and have a certain agenda. So you can't take a document always at face value. And the wonderful thing about the Vasiliev notebooks is that it enabled us to literally cross-reference things with the Venona material, with the material that I had found in Comintern archives back in the early 90s, with Vasily Mitrokhin's material. He was a KGB archivist that had copied a lot of material and turned it over to the British. So the material cross-checked, and that gave us a great deal of confidence in its veracity.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get one thing out of the way. The Soviets are famous for fabricating documents. Is there any question about the authenticity of the Vasiliev notebooks?
Well, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think there is. I might add in terms of what we did to authenticate them. In order to get all of this material properly translated, was an expensive proposition, so we needed to seek a foundation grant to get it done. And we knew one of the requirements of getting that done would be an effort to fully authenticate the material. So at a very early stage, what we did was bring Alexander and his notebooks to Washington, where we had a two-day meeting where a group of historians and retired intelligence officers examined Alexander's notebooks, discussed with him the origins of them, how he did things, and essentially went over his story and over his notebooks. And there was unanimous agreement of the entire group when it was over that this stuff was authentic. Mm-hmm. Now, in addition, as Harvey explained, in our own work, we, of course, compared Alexander's material with the Venona decryptions, with the testimony of that had occurred in various trials, with FBI files, with Matrokin's material in England, and it all fit together. I mean, that everything cross checks, everything fits. So we are totally confident of its authenticity. Mm-hmm. And I might add, this material has now been public since 2009. Plenty of hostile historians out there who don't like what we have had to say, and they have been utterly, completely unable to find any holes in the material.
Mm-hmm. I see. So let me ask what I think is the most important question about your research, and let me give a little preface about it. I'm of the generation of historians. We were working in the archives when the archives so-called opened in 1991, and I saw the publications that came out after that and continue to come out today. And one of the things that really surprised me is actually how little we learned that we didn't already know. And I think I can explain this pretty well. And this is about the internal goings-on in the Soviet Union. We knew a heck of a lot about the Soviet Union. It was the most studied place in world history by a foreign power. We invested millions and zillions of dollars to do it. And in fact, we had done a very good job of it. We knew how the place ran in quite significant detail. And what we found in the archives, at least I think what we found in the archives, did mostly confirmed what we already knew. What did you learn in these documents that we did not already know?
Well, I think there are several things that we learned, and Harvey will have some examples, I think, as well. I think first is, in terms of dealing with some things which, in a sense, we already knew, there were a number of things which we already knew but were nonetheless still contested,
mm-hmm.
Such as the extent of Julius Rosenberg's espionage. You know, until Venona came out, there were still plenty of people claiming he was totally innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other famous spy cases as well, they were still contested. Between Venona and Alexander's notebooks, essentially those controversies are over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that that even though they were contested, one side was right, one side was wrong. Now, there are some things which, in a sense, I think are totally new. One is, and I think this is really an example of a very important unknown spy, William Weisband. He was a translator for what is now the National Security Agency, our cryptographic agency. He went to work for them in 1946 and continued there until the FBI uncovered him as a Soviet agent. Now, because of the nature of his work and the nature of the evidence that was used, he actually was never tried. He was in prison briefly because he refused to testify to a grand jury, and so he was jailed under contempt of court. But this was a case that never got any kind of publicity. Most people have never heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that he made available to the Soviets around 1947, he informed them that, was in the predecessor to NSA, was reading virtually all of the Soviet military logistics traffic in real time. So we knew where all of their units were, what kind of supplies they had, their ammunition stocks, fuel stocks, all that kind of thing. And that allowed our military to be able to sort out what was the real threat and what was a fake, just how serious a threat we faced in various places around the world, particularly in Europe, and gave us a great deal of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of Weisband's treachery in revealing it to the Soviets changed all of their logistics ciphers and went to a far more sophisticated system, and we lost that access. It's mm-hmm. known in NSA history as Black Friday. Actually, it took about a month for them to change all the codes. But that we went from reading virtually all of their logistics traffic to reading none of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has some major consequences. One of them is the Korean War. If we had still maintained that kind of access to Soviet logistics traffic, we would have seen the Korean War coming. We would have seen a massive Soviet buildup of supplies going to the North Korean army.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have either possibly headed off the war by diplomatic means, or at least it would not have been the kind of utter total military surprise it was when the North Koreans attacked. So, in one sense, William Weisband has a lot of blood on his hands
mm-hmm.
because of his really setting the stage for the Korean War.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I certainly had never heard of him.
Yeah.
So, Harvey, do you have some examples of things that?
One example, you know, Weisband is somebody that NSA was or the FBI was aware of before Vasilyev's material was released. The American public obviously was not. An example of somebody who was exposed by the Vasilyev material is a man named Russell McNutt. In the Venona material, there was an unknown spy who was involved in atomic espionage, who had different cover names at various times. One of them was Fogel, another was Pers. A lot of speculation about who this person was, and nobody knew. Certainly the FBI never knew. They tried very hard to identify him, but could not. Vasilyev's notebooks identified him. He was a man named Russell McNutt. We were able to track him down. Russell McNutt was an engineer. He was a good friend of Julius Rosenberg. And in fact, Julius Rosenberg had recruited him. Russell McNutt got a job in an engineering company that was building the facilities at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, during World War II, where uranium separation was taking place. And Russell McNutt turned over drawings of the various buildings to the KGB, which, of course, was useful because it helped them understand what the United States was doing in atomic espionage, building an atomic bomb. The incredible thing about Russell McNutt, we traced his background and found out that his father had been a communist, founder of the Communist Party in Kansas, and actually a good friend of Earl Browder, who had been the leader of the American Communist Party. The incredible thing is we found out Russell McNutt was still alive when we were writing the book. And he had become a vice president of Gulf Oil Company. He was the man that built Reston, Virginia. He was it was a company called Gulf Reston that built Reston, Virginia, and Russell McNutt was in charge of it. You know, a lot of CIA people lived in Reston, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and here the guy who built it was a long unknown Soviet spy. He had retired and developed a resort community in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina with a Lee Trevino designed golf course, and he was still living up there.
Mm.
And in fact, I called him up and spoke to him. He was in his 90s. He acknowledged remembering Julius Rosenberg. And then I told him what was in Alexander Vasilyev's notebooks. And at that point, he said, "Who did you say you are?" And the conversation took a more difficult turn.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to see some of the things that John and I had written, which I sent him, and the next time I called him, he professed to have no recollection of anything, which was entirely possible. He was 93 or 94 mm-hmm. years old, and he mm-hmm. died about a year or so later. But that's an example of one of the things that we didn't know, and we discovered that some... some people had gotten away with it with espionage.
Mm-hmm. But much of what you guys did was you put to bed many of these controversies. Like, for example, Hiss. Does anybody doubt that Hiss was a spy now?
There's still a few people. there's a website at New York University that's sort of devoted to his innocence. But I think it's a losing battle.
Yeah, yeah. But the Rosenbergs, at least for Julius Rosenberg, nobody doubts that now. That's... Even his son,
nobody,
I heard his son, you know, yeah.
Yeah, including his sons. And, yeah. And, you know, we've also, I think, established that some people were innocent. We present, I think, a pretty convincing case that Robert Oppenheimer did not spy for the mm-hmm. Soviet Union, mm-hmm. in spite of charges of some people that he did. Now, there's fascinating material on Oppenheimer in Vasilyev's notebooks, indicating that Oppenheimer lied that he actually had been a member of the American Communist Party, and probably his lying about that is what sort of led him to a impossible position where he eventually lost his security clearance. But there's abundant evidence that the KGB tried very, very hard to recruit him, and they failed.
Mm-hmm. I see. So let's talk in a little more general terms. What did you learn through these in these documents about the way in which the KGB did recruit people? Did they simply go after people who had been Communist Party members, or how did they do it?
John, you want to go ahead?
Yeah. It depends on the era you're looking at. We go back to the 1930s, for example. The Soviet agencies tended to avoid using people who were active in the Communist Party because they thought it was a security risk. Now, they would use them occasionally to do some tasks, but they didn't like to recruit party members themselves as sources because they thought the Communist Party was probably infiltrated by the FBI. They were wrong. Actually, the FBI wasn't doing much about the Communist Party in that time. And they also thought if someone had a background of communist political activity, if it ever did become the subject of a security investigation, that would come to light very quickly. So they tended to try to avoid recruiting people who were active in the Communist Party. But, and this is, I think, a fascinating part of what the notebook show, Soviet espionage in the United States took a massive hit and was really crippled in 1938 and 1939, not by anything American security agencies did, but because of Stalin's purges of his own security agencies. Many of the senior KGB officers, actually I had a different name back then, but let's just use KGB to keep things straight, many of the senior officers who had been working in the United States were recalled to the Soviet Union and shot. And by you get to the point in the late of 1939, their illegal operations in the United States were totally shut down. All of the officers had been recalled and many of them shot. The intelligence operations that were running out of the diplomatic agencies called the legal station had been reduced to only one experienced intelligence officer and some junior people who didn't even speak English very well. And that was all due to Stalin's purges. All right, then, so that carries on until 1941. They really are doing very little at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then Germany attacks the Soviet Union. Of course, at that point, Stalin requires the Soviet intelligence to ramp up all over the place, including he wants major operations in the United States. And so the KGB has to send over new officers and reestablish everything very quickly. Now, you know, if they'd done it the right way, the old way, they would have sent over officers and got acclimatized over time and slowly built up networks. Again, they probably would have avoided using party members. But this was wartime. Things were urgent. They had to do things very quickly. So they decided to take risk. And one of the things they did was to put aside the risk of using active communists. And they went to the Communist Party and asked for full cooperation, if the communists were delighted to provide, of course. And so they used the party's political apparatus, that is, its network of secret party members in government agencies, which were simply political, ordinarily you might call it subversion, but they weren't involved in intelligence, to turn over these politically based networks over to the KGB for espionage. And that was highly successful in this period, and really kind of the golden age from 1942 to 1945, of using secret party members in various government agencies and turning them into spies. That all, however, that then came crashing down in late 1945 with the defection of Elizabeth Bentley, and then because she was the liaison between the Communist Party and Soviet intelligence operations, and she knew most of the agents, and particularly she knew the Soviet officers who were involved with it, and they all had to be withdrawn from the United States.
Mm-hmm. I would just add to what John is saying, that there's a wonderful thing in the Vasiliev notebooks where the KGB asks one of their American, he was not himself a spy, but he worked in these networks as a courier and agent handler and so on. They asked him to look into some issues, and he tells the KGB officer in charge of the American operations that it's a disaster waiting to happen, that these networks with which Bentley is affiliated, everybody knows everybody else. I mean, and of course, in espionage, you want to compartmentalize. Mm-hmm. One spy doesn't know, you know, who else is spying. Well, these networks, these were Communist Party networks, so these people used to get together for Communist Party meetings. Mm-hmm. Well, they were all spies now, and they knew what everybody else was doing. And they, at their meetings, they would talk about who had what assignment. Mm-hmm. And who was supposed to get what information. And this guy, he says, and his name was Joseph Katz, he says, you know, this is all it's going to take is one defection, and the entire operation is going to come crashing down. These people get together with their wives, and they talk about who's spying and who has what kind of assignment. And, of course, that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Bentley, you know, Bentley was a strange woman. She was a Vassar graduate. She had gone to Italy in to study in the early 1930s, and was sort of appalled by fascism. She came back to the United States and sort of dabbled in Communist Party activities, and then she was recruited and assigned to a man named Jacob Golis, who became her lover. And Golis was an American communist who also had Soviet connections. He'd lived for a number of years in the Soviet Union. And Golis was the man that was in charge of all these apparatuses in Washington. And Bentley became his courier. Golis died of a heart attack in 1943, I think it was. And Bentley sort of took over running these networks. The KGB was very quickly aware that Bentley was a loose cannon. She was an alcoholic. She was, I guess this phrase isn't used these days, but she was a nymphomaniac. She just slept with everybody. And, you know, one of the Soviet officers was scandalized when she propositioned him. She was very bitter. The Soviets began to, they realized she was not entirely reliable, and they tried to ease her out of her role, and that just fed her paranoia and anger. And eventually, she went to the FBI.
Mm-hmm. And after the FBI got the information?
Well, the first they didn't believe her.
I can imagine.
but they gradually did start to believe her, and they began to surveil the people that she had named. But unfortunately for the FBI, Bentley's statement, including all the people that she had named, had been sent to Moscow. I can't remember, John, was it what, within a week after she made it?
Yeah, within 10 days. That was, the FBI had shared Bentley's statement, which was extremely long in detail, which was prepared after she was being interviewed by the FBI for over a month. They had shared it with British intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI had a very close relationship with British intelligence. Unfortunately, among the people in British intelligence who saw the report was Kim Philby.
Yeah.
Who was, of course, a Soviet spy. And he promptly got a copy of the report off to Moscow. And once the KGB got a hold of it in Moscow, well, they sent emergency orders to the United States to warn all the people that Bentley had named to, you know, burn anything you have and prepare your cover stories and get ready for an FBI interview.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember being in the Soviet Union and seeing a Kim Philby stamp. I don't know. We don't have those in the United States, do we? Do we have any famous spies on stamps? I don't think we do that. But, yeah, you could buy a stamp and send a letter in the Soviet Union with Kim Philby on it. Have you guys ever seen those?
No.
You haven't? No, they exist. I'm not making that up.
Yeah, well, we don't have a Kim Philby stamp, but we do have an Alger Hiss professor professorship at Bard College.
Do we really?
Yeah, we do. You know, one of the great ironies is that the guy that used to hold it was a very far left kind of crazed man. The guy that holds it now is the person who was our editor at Yale Press who published spies, Jonathan Brent, who of course is an anti-communist,
yeah, right,
but he holds the Alger Hiss professorship.
Wow, that is ironic. So, let's move on to kind of more general interpretation. Does the material that you discovered and published in Spies, does it put McCarthyism in a different light?
I think it does. You know, we're often asked the question of whether this vindicates McCarthy and McCarthyism. And my answer always has been, and I think John would agree with this, first of all, Joseph McCarthy did not initiate sort of the Red Scare or a spy, you know, search for spies or anything else. He's pretty much of a latecomer. McCarthy was right on the large issue. There had been significant Soviet infiltration of American government, American military secrets, and so on. He was wrong on most, not all, but most of the particulars. McCarthy did identify a handful of people who we now know genuinely were Soviet spies. Now, most of the people he identified were not, you know, they were not major spies. They were not at the level of somebody like William Weisband or Russell McNutt. But they were working for the Soviet Union. But McCarthy also accused a lot of people that were innocent. And his charges were really scattershot and quite wild. And I think ultimately McCarthy wound up hurting the cause of anti-communism and indeed the search for Soviet spies because his charges were so wild. But he was right on the larger issue.
John, you want to weigh in on that one?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that, in a sense, the new material that we have certainly vindicates, in a sense, the kind of post-war anti-communism and the concern about Soviet infiltration of government agencies. But as Harvey says, on the particulars of McCarthy's targets, I think one of the things to keep in mind is McCarthy, in terms of his major charges, he was not really aiming at the Communist Party or even at Soviet spies. He was aiming at the Truman administration. And he was using anti-communism as a club to pound away at the Truman administration and the legacy of the New Deal. For instance, his most famous target was George Marshall, who had been Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. You know, he accused Marshall of being part of a, as he called it, a conspiracy so immense that it dwarfs any conspiracy in history. Well, that's utter, complete, total nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in any of this material that in any way implicates George Marshall or any of the other major figures in the Truman administration that were the targets of McCarthy's attacks.
Well, let's turn the question around a little bit and ask this. And I don't know if I've ever heard this question really asked and seriously answered. What did the Soviets get out of all this? How did they benefit? What did they learn that they didn't know that was of great value? I mean, that we can say just absolutely they got this from us, and they benefited greatly from it.
Well, the first, and I think the most important thing is the atomic bomb. Lots of material had already come out about Soviet atomic espionage. Obviously, Klaus Fuchs, the German-born British scientist who had been at Los Alamos. Fuchs was identified through the Venona decryptions, and he confessed. David Greenglass, Julius Rosenberg's brother-in-law, had been a machinist at Los Alamos, and Julius had recruited him to spy. And now, a lot of people had argued that David Greenglass was a really minor or inconsequential spy, if he was a spy at all, because the material he turned over couldn't have been very much value. The Vasiliev notebooks make it clear that Soviets did greatly value Greenglass's material, in part because it corroborated other information they were getting, which was important. Russell McNutt, several other spies that have now been, atomic spies, have now been exposed by Venona and the Vasiliev notebooks. And so we now know that without atomic espionage, the Soviets would have taken them, estimates vary, 2 to 5 years longer to build an atomic bomb, and certainly a great deal more expense. They didn't have to go down some of the unproductive paths that the United States had to do to develop an atomic bomb. And the first Soviet bomb was a carbon copy of the American bomb, and they got that through espionage. So that was, I think that was certainly the most significant set of materials that espionage provided to the Soviet Union.
John?
Yes, I would agree with that, and I think it makes a difference as to when the Soviets got the bomb. If it had been delayed 2 or 3 years, that would have meant the Soviets would not have had the bomb until after Stalin's death. Well, it makes a great deal of difference whether it was the Soviets developed the bomb under Stalin or one of his far less frightening successors. The other thing, which I talked about earlier, is the enormous damage done to American security by William Weisband and the information he provided about our electronic and cryptographic intelligence. Now, you know, America is good at some kinds of intelligence and not at others. In terms of human intelligence, I'm not sure that's one of our strengths. But when it comes to electronic intelligence, code breaking, interception and that kind of thing, we are the best in the world. And that has always served us well. Well, it didn't serve us, it couldn't serve us the way it could have because of William Weisband. And as I said, his revealing to the Soviets that we were breaking into Soviet military logistics traffic allowed them to change their codes and stop our access to it, which set the stage for the Korean War. And that was a very, very awful thing to happen.
I see. So I'm glad you mentioned that because I was going to, I don't know this either, and I really am ashamed to profess my ignorance. Did the United States have a network of spies in the Soviet Union? Do we know that? I mean,
Not very many.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things to remember is during World War II, it was our policy not to spy on the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
We did not develop any agents in Russia or in any area that was occupied by the Soviets. We thought it would be bad for our alliance relationships if we were seen to be developing intelligence operations with our ally. The Soviets, of course, had an entirely different point of view. To them, the wartime alliance was an opportunity to build up their intelligence operations mm-hmm. in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And there's a fascinating sort of sidelight of this is that the Soviets, Moscow, insisted that Kim Philby, Donald McLean, and Guy Burgess, who were their prize spies, and Anthony Blunt, their prize spies in Great Britain, they wanted them to provide information about the British spies in the Soviet Union. And all of them reported that there were none, that Churchill had issued an order that during as long as the Soviets and British were allies, that the British weren't going to spy on the Soviet Union. Well, Stalin's reaction to that was, this must mean that Philby and these guys are actually double agents, that they're working for the British, because of course the British would. I mean, he knew what he was doing. And so we know that, because there are memos that have come out, that for at least a year or so, the Soviets were disregarding information that Philby and those guys were sending because they were convinced it was disinformation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is a wilderness of mirrors.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing, though, actually. It makes the United States and the I didn't expect this from the British, but it makes the United States seem sort of naive. But we were, after all, sending people over there. Lee Harvey Oswald being the most famous of them, I think. But he didn't do anybody much good, I guess, in the end. So it's an absolutely fascinating story. I'm really glad that we got a chance to talk today. And we're about out of time, so I want to take the last few moments of the interview to ask each of you in turn what you are working on now. John, maybe we could start with you.
Well, actually, Harvey and I are working on a common project. We do a lot of writing together, and we're just finishing up working on a new book for Yale University Press in partnership with a Russian historian, Friedrich Firsov, a history of the Communist International, the Comintern, based on a set of Comintern documents that Firsov, who used to be the chief historian at the archive that holds the Comintern's records, based on a set of material that he brought over with him when he moved to the United States about a decade ago. So it highlights a number of aspects of Communist international history in the 1930s and early 40s up to the time of its dissolution. Again, I don't think you'll find in this book any huge unknown revelations, but you will find a great deal of detail and more complete documentation of things which we either knew or suspected.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I should say also that work is terribly important because, there are a lot of open historical questions and we don't know. I mean, the most famous of them, I think, are actually in the area in which you work. But, historians commonly do produce what I call closers, right? So this was an open question, and a historian spends 10 years on it, and now it's not. And in a sense, that's what you folks have done, is use these documents to kind of end debate on this so we can move forward to ask more interesting questions. Why, for example, were people so easily recruited? What role did the Communist Party have in politics in the United States? Why aren't Americans interested in communism? This kind of thing. So it kind of gets us past these very contentious, I guess I would call them non-starters, because you start to talk to somebody about these issues and you mention Rosenberg or Hiss or one of these fellows, and pretty much used to be the case in the 80s that conversation stopped. And now I think we can move forward. So I'm going to congratulate you on writing the book. Today we've been talking to John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare about their book Spies, The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America. They co-wrote it with Alexander Vasiliev. Again, I want to thank both you guys for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.